Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the militarization of America's police forces and examine how some of the most advanced lethal and non-lethal military equipment in the world is going to police forces across the country to be used against U.S. citizens. Rania Kalik, a Washington, D.C.-based writer for Alternet, joins us. She has an article at Alternet, Pepper Spray, Tasers, and LRADs, What's Behind the Explosion of Less Lethal Weapons for Crowd Control. Then we will speak with Mary Beth Fiedler, the founder and coordinator of Move to Amend LA, who spearheaded the successful effort to get the LA City Council to approve a resolution to amend the Constitution to deny corporations personhood. And then we will speak with a Congolese activist about the disputed elections in the Congo that are likely to spark a new round of violence in a country where millions have died despite the presence of the world's largest contingent of UN peacekeepers. Jacques Bahati, the policy analyst for Africa Faith and Justice Network, joins us. I'm now speaking with Rania Kalik, who is a Washington, D.C.-based journalist for Alternet. Some of Rania's articles will be featured alongside other prominent writers in an upcoming book published by Alternet about the Occupy Wall Street movement. And you can find her latest article at alternet.org, Pepper Spray, Tasers, and LRADs, What's Behind the Explosion of Less Lethal Weapons for Crowd Control. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rania Kalik.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Ian.
And let's start with lethal equipment, of which there is a growing amount. Apparently, it all started with something that I'd never heard of, the 1033 program. The 1033 program that this year gave $500 million of military equipment to United States police forces. This was passed in Congress in 1997 to help law enforcement fight terrorism and drugs. So I guess, how does this gel, though? We have the 40-year lowest crime rate in history, you know, a 40-year low in violent crime, yet the police in this country are getting this incredibly lethal military hardware, tanks and machine guns and all that stuff. And apparently this year they've gotten $500 million, and next year there are orders for $2 billion worth. What's going on here?
Well, let me just start by pointing out that that 1033 program you're talking about, while that was instituted in the Defense Authorization Act in 1997, I believe it was. The Defense Authorization Security Act. It actually wasn't where that began. When this entire idea of getting military equipment into the hands of local police departments started was actually with the beginning of the war on drugs. So even before the war on terror, basically, we have the Posse Comitatus Act, which is like a post-Civil War era act, right, that, you know, says that we can't use the military for domestic law enforcement. And so that act was pretty much a law of the land for a very long time, up until the late 70s and then early 80s, when the war on drugs got pretty intense and serious. And it one of the first congressional maneuvers to pass was the Military Cooperation with Law Enforcement Act in 1981. And that act basically directed the military to give local and state law enforcement access to military equipment for research and training. So that was sort of where this all begins. And then there's, you know, a whole slew of other congressional presidential maneuvers in the 80s and even the 90s that basically enhanced the ability of, you know, the military to get its weapons into the hands of local police departments. And then by 1997, with the 1033 program, that basically accelerated that, what's called the military surplus. It's a military surplus program, which is basically, you know, the military has all this equipment that just lies around and doesn't get used because it's constantly getting, you know, new equipment and new funding for even newer equipment. So they basically get to, they sell this equipment to local police departments at a very discounted rate, sometimes they just give it to them for free. And so the 1033 program basically helps accelerate that. But even more than just that, we also have the war on terror, which, really exploded the amount of military weaponry in local police departments because of Department of Homeland Security grants, which is a completely different program. And basically that allocates a certain amount of money to various local and state police departments for them to spend on equipment. And, you know, that can be bulletproof vests or desks, but sometimes it's also, you know, they're not really tanks, these tank-like vehicles and machine guns and whatnot. Right. So it's just this entire industry that's blown up around military-grade equipment for law enforcement.
So what do you think, Rania Kalik, how is it that we have a 40-year low in violent crime, and yet this year the military essentially gave away $500 million in military equipment to the police forces, and next year it'll be $2 billion. There's a disconnect here between reality and the arming of our police.
Yeah, well, this is very much fueled by the war on drugs and then the war on terror. These are the justifications for getting this kind of equipment into the hands of local police departments. They say that, you know, the justification is, well, we need tanks because we need to be able to protect ourselves in case of a terrorist strike or in case of, you know, drug violence or whatever it may be. So with this being the justification, I mean, as long as most war on terror and the war on drugs are, you know, these never-ending, ridiculous wars that really aren't based in reality at all. So it's really dependent on those two situations. The fact that these weapons keep, you know, making their way.
Sure.
Into your backyard.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Rania Kalik, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist for Alternet. She has an article at Alternet, Pepper Spray, Tasers, and LRADs, What's Behind the Explosion of Less Lethal Weapons for Crowd Control. And just to be a little specific here about the kind of equipment we're talking about, Cobb County, Georgia, has a new amphibious tank, the same one that the Marines use when they storm the beaches. The sheriff of Richland County, South Carolina, acquired a machine gun-equipped armored personnel carrier that he nicknamed the Peacemaker. And then you mentioned, Rania, the grants from the Department of Homeland Security. They've enabled police departments to buy this vehicle called the Bearcat, which is a 16,000-pound bulletproof truck equipped with battering rams, gun points, tear gas dispensers, and radiation detectors. And to date, that's the one you were thinking about, the Bearcat. To date, more than 500 of these have been essentially given away to police departments. That's 500 is a lot of tanks. I mean,
and some of them are in some of the most, rural areas imaginable. I mean, there's places in Kansas that have these armored vehicles. I mean, where you know, crime is very, very low. The notion that you're going to have some kind of battle, you know, in the middle of a very, very small town is slim to none. So a lot of these weapons are going to places where there's really, you can't even come up with a pretend justification for them.
Right, but my understanding is what happens to these police forces that get this equipment, either essentially given to them by the Pentagon through this congressional act, or from grants from the Department of Homeland Security, when this little town in Kansas has a big tank, then they decide that they have to create a paramilitary unit to justify it and make it a part of their SWAT teams. So isn't it sort of self-reinforcing, the militarization? Once you get the military equipment, then you want to train your guys to use it, surely.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that's one of the scariest parts, is that we basically turned local police departments into these small paramilitary units, even just outside of SWAT teams. SWAT teams look and dress like soldiers, but now so do a lot of our local police officers. And when you dress people like soldiers and you train them like soldiers, they might end up acting like soldiers. And, the scary part about that is that soldiers and police officers have two very, very different roles. Soldiers are supposed to, defeat the enemy, and police officers are supposed to, be peacekeepers and uphold the Constitution and our rights. So it is a really scary dynamic that we've got police officers walking around and, mentally trained to act as though they're soldiers.
Again, I'm speaking with Rania Kalik, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist, writes for Alternet. She has an article at Alternet, Pepper Spray, Tasers, and LRADs, What's Behind the Explosion of Less Lethal Weapons for Crowd Control. So let's talk about this other aspect now. We talked about lethal weaponry, battlefield-tested serious weaponry, tanks, machine guns, and God knows what else. Now we're going to talk about the less lethal weapons. These, I believe, evolved, and by the way, they're both used by the military in places like Afghanistan, and the Egyptian military have used it in Tahrir Square, etc. So it's not exclusively about domestic crowd control. But your article points out that it all evolved because of the media, that they wanted more media-friendly weapons. Is that right?
Right. And I mean, that's kind of, you know, it's almost laughable, but because it is very serious. This is these less lethal weapons. And what I mean by that is, you know, when we talk about pepper spray and tasers and tear gas and all these weapons that are basically meant to disperse crowds or subdue, you know, individuals who may not be complying with police orders, whatever it may be, these weapons are basically meant to coerce people to act a certain way without actually, you know, without physically harming them or you know, killing them. Oftentimes it's not the case. You know, they do end up physically injuring them. But these weapons have their roots in the 60s and 70s when, you know, the rise of television during the civil rights era, when police were using fire hoses and dogs to attack civil rights protesters, and these awful, brutal images of unarmed peaceful protesters, you know, were aired all around the country and the world, and people were outraged, and this led to a lot, you know, this galvanized the civil rights movement, but it also led to riots. And so there was this, there was a commission that was put together to figure out how to basically figure out why these riots and protests were happening, A, but B, also to figure out how to deal with crowds, how to deal with crowd control. This is called the Kerner Commission, and what they found was that, you know, this excessive force that injured and killed protesters was making the situation more tense and making it more likely that there'd be a riot and that there'd be more protests. So it suggested, the commission suggested that there be, you know, research and federal money invested in weapons that aren't lethal along the lines of the way tear gas works. Tear gas was around at the time, but it was mostly used by the military. And so this sort of sparked an entire industry of, you know, these weapons, it sparked these big weapons, or I'm sorry, these long lethal weapons getting into the hands of local police departments. And so the pepper spray, and the taser was invented. But basically this time it was just pepper spray and tasers and tear gas, and mostly tear gas. But after this time, at this point, the military wasn't interested in this kind of weaponry until, you know, you had these 24-hour cable news stations, first and foremost, CNN, the rise of CNN, they were the first station to really, you know, air an entire war. The Gulf War was literally made for TV. And so there was other situations going on as well. There was the Rodney King affair, where he was beaten severely. This black man in L.A. was beaten by the LAPD, and it was caught on videotape. There were situations going on around the world in other countries, the uprisings in Eastern Europe after the Soviet Union fell. So all of this stuff is being aired on TV, and it's having an impact on the way people think about policy decisions. So policymakers were really worried that their ability to do their jobs would be affected by public opinion. So this is when the military got heavily invested in the idea of non-lethal weapons, because this way they could fight wars that were becoming more, you know, urbanized wars, and they could deal with crowds in a way that wouldn't look so bad on television, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah. In other words, you wouldn't want a machine gun mow down women and children on CNN.
Yeah.
But what's going on here with this? There's a group called Homeland Security Research Corporation, which you mentioned in your article. I take it that's just one of the kind of parasites that have cropped up to get their fist in the government trough, since Homeland Security spends $1 trillion without knowing what its mission is. They have predicted that the global market for less lethal or non-lethal weapons will triple by 2020. So yeah, this appears to be a global arms race, but the opponents is the general population.
Right. I mean, if you look at the way the economy is right now globally, you've got a situation where austerity is being imposed on populations on every continent. And you've got a situation where climate change is starting to affect a lot of developing countries that already aren't doing so well. And you've got governments that are largely focused on propping up banks, the banks, rather than helping everyday people. So people are angry. You've got protests in Spain, protests in Greece, you have protests in Italy, and then you've got protests in the Middle East. You've got protests in Egypt and Yemen and Bahrain and all these places that, you've got all these people, crying out for democracy, crying out for their governments to start heeding their demands. And the fear is, of course, that, this is a threat, right? This is a threat to the powers that be. So you've got countries all around the world are actually invested in these non-lethal weapons. I mean, Egypt right now is using tear gas, has used tear gas nonstop on its population, mostly tear gas bought in the U.S. You've got, crowd control sort of the next war to come. And it's already happening. I mean, Occupy Wall Street right now is really showing that, crowd control, and we have riot police. These are unarmed people protesting. We have riot police coming in hundreds and sometimes thousands to come raid Occupy encampments of peaceful, nonviolent protesters. And they're using things like pepper spray and tear gas, and in the case of Oakland, flashbang grenades. And I mean, just these horrendous weapons. But, these weapons compared to machine guns or police dogs are much different when you air them on television, because some people are sort of immune to the brutality. It shelters people from the brutality of these weapons, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
Sure. Well, again, I speak with Rania Kalik, who's Washington, D.C.-based journalist for Alternet. She has an article at alternet.org, Pepper Spray, Tasers, and LRADs, What's Behind the Explosion of Less Lethal Weapons for Crowd Control. What are LRADs?
LRADs are long-distance acoustic devices. The sound, the sonic cannons that broadcast a really loud, uncomfortable sound that can actually cause permanent hearing damage if you're too close to it.
I see. So that as opposed to driving Noriega crazy when he was holed up in the Vatican envoy's place in Panama with loud rock music.
Exactly.
But you in your article you quote from a Pentagon report, a joint report. This is 1997 at the time that they instituted this 1033 program. 1997 report, joint report from the Pentagon and the Justice Department about non-lethal weapons. Just quoting it. A further consideration that affects how the military and law enforcement apply forces is the greater presence of members of the media or other civilians who are observing, if not recording, the situation. Even the lawful application of force can be misrepresented or misunderstood by the public. More than ever, the police and the military must be highly discreet when applying force. So we've had the discreet application of force here in Los Angeles when they got rid of the encampment at LA City Hall, and
right.
It was done discreetly. But the violence took place afterwards when they had all these kids penned up in the basement of the Parker Center or in the county jail or in the buses that they used. That's when they roughed them up and deprived them and humiliated them. And so it's so much of what we're talking about seems to be about out of sight and out of mind.
Right, and I mean it's interesting because in LA, I mean, you had a lot of media outlets at first praising the actions taken by the LAPD for being peaceful. And so, yeah, it's interesting how these, that sort of being discreet is, I mean, they're very candid about it. You know, law enforcement, the military, they're very, very candid about it. It's not a secret that these weapons are used for the reason that they're used. And it's not a secret that, when the media is around, you have to act differently. It's just the way it's just the way the game is played.
Right, but what concerns me and what seems to be the trend here, if we have a 40-year low in violent crime, yet they're quadrupling the amount of military equipment next year, that we're talking about tanks and heavy equipment, and the Department of Homeland Security just giving away all of this heavy lethal equipment and non-lethal equipment to all of these police forces, in even in tiny rural communities, So if violent crime goes down and police military equipment goes up, at the end of the day, isn't this going to be used against citizens for political activism, as opposed to, because the violent criminals are few and far between, and less of them apparently, in spite of this drug war and you know, the terrorists, is the last one was some hapless idiot in Times Square. So is that where we're heading?
You know, I would argue that that's, you know, what we're already seeing. And I mean, I'm not saying that we're going to go out into the street and have, you know, militias, you know, police officers, you know, waiting outside with tear gas. But, you know, if you're politically against the ruling elite, if you just look at Occupy Wall Street, that's what we're already seeing, is you see this stuff is being used against peaceful, unarmed protesters. And even without there being protests or crowds to control, these weapons, just the fact that police have them and they're, you know, they get used. I mean, look at all the people that get tasered all the time. You see people getting tasered not for being violent, but for being noncompliant, for just not doing what the police are specifically telling them to do. So you have this sort of culture and this mentality of, it's almost like an authoritarian kind of mentality. Like, you have to listen to our commands, and we have this big intimidation of force, you know?
Well, I guess it's preferable. It's preferable to being shot, though.
I would argue that's true.
if it comes down to the police are going to shoot you or tase you, I guess the latter is probably a preference. Well,
exactly.
Rania, thank you so much for joining us. And next time you write something, let me know, because I'm interested in this subject.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Rania Kalik, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist for Alternet. Some of Rania's articles will be featured alongside other prominent writers in an upcoming book published by Alternet about the Occupy Wall Street movement. And you can find her latest article at alternet.org, Pepper Spray, Tasers, and LRADs, What's Behind the Explosion of Less Lethal Weapons for Crowd Control. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the L.A. City Council just passed an amendment to stop corporations from claiming personhood.
Jealous, words try to control. They what we say, try to stop what we do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mary Beth Fiedler, the founder and coordinator of Move to Amend LA, who spearheaded the successful effort to get the LA City Council to approve a resolution amending the Constitution to deny corporations personhood. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Beth Fiedler.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be here.
And so you're a happy camper, right? You've scored a victory for the people over the corporations.
Yes, we're extremely ecstatic. We also built an amazing coalition of groups here in Los Angeles that galvanized around this issue and have been working together for the last... we started back in January working towards this specific goal of getting a resolution through the LA City Council, but other groups have come on board, and especially Common Cause has been extremely helpful. Helped also seek other endorsement partners, and Occupy LA were very supportive throughout the process, and many, many other groups. The County Federation of Labor was an endorser, and all of these different groups, reached out to their members, and together we packed the City Hall chambers, and in fact, we even overflowed the overflow room. So it was really a great day for democracy, and we're really thrilled.
So the council president, Eric Garcetti, seems to have played an important role, along with council members Bill Rosendahl, Paul Krikorian, Richard Alacon, and Paul Koretz. Eric Garcetti said, "Every struggle to amend the Constitution began as just a group of regular Americans who wanted to end slavery, who thought women should vote, who believed that if you're young enough to be drafted, you should be old enough to vote." So that's putting it in a very lofty historical context. Where do you go from now?
Well, from here, we're hoping that this vote will be an inspiration to other cities and towns across the United States to pass similar resolutions. Move to Amend's national strategy is to have at least 50 more resolutions on the ballot in cities across the United States. Ours was actually came through the city council. With a city as large as Los Angeles, would be a real challenge to get actually a ballot initiative. But some of smaller cities have put it on the ballot. Missoula, Montana, Boulder, Colorado, Madison, Wisconsin. And that's a great way because it really engages the voters because they have to, vote on it. And so we're going to try working with a lot of the surrounding smaller cities and either get it on the ballot in those cities or, go through a process like we did through the city council. And one of the points of these resolutions is really to build the kind of awareness of the issue, educate people, and the grassroots support that we will need to actually amend the Constitution because we need a really huge amount of support to accomplish that. And so the challenge is to make a lot of people understand the issue and its importance and how it affects our democracy.
Well, the founding fathers set a pretty high bar for you, Mary Beth Fiedler. To amend the Constitution requires two-thirds votes in two-thirds of the state legislatures, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, and then it goes on. It has to be ratified by three-quarters of the state. So this is, but it's been done before, and as Council President Garcetti mentioned, getting African Americans the right to vote, women the right to vote was a long protracted struggle. We're hoping it won't be that long. I think in today's climate and with the internet, it's going to be actually much shorter than we had even been thinking back in January when we started this locally. And Move to Amend has been working as a national coalition since right after Citizens United. And originally they were saying 10 to 15 years, but I think now we're thinking more 5 years, maybe 3 to 5 years. And that of course depends though on us, the people and all the people out there who want this to happen, coming together and really, rolling up your sleeves and working together to do this grassroots organizing to educate and make people understand the importance of the issue. I mean, I think it depends on how hard we work to make it happen.
Again, I'm speaking with Mary Beth Fiedler, the founder and coordinator of Move to Amend LA, who spearheaded the successful effort to get the LA City Council to approve a resolution amending the Constitution to deny corporations personhood. And you just mentioned the Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission 2010 U.S. Supreme Court ruling. That, of course, is the beginning of this movement. The president, shortly thereafter, before the joint session of the Congress, castigated the justices, which prompted one of the justices to contradict the president in public. In terms of a legal remedy, there is none. There's nothing to be done with the court because now, there's an effort to get Justice Thomas to recuse himself from any deliberations on health care. Is there anything that can be done at the Supreme Court level? It's just a done deal. Is that the way it is?
Well, basically, unless there's a change in the composition of the Supreme Court and with the ages of the current justices, that doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. So
right, and if the Republicans win the next election,
then it'll
never happen, right? Right. So so you can't change it at the court level because you don't have the enough of people on the court to revisit it. What about the Congress passing a law to change it?
Well, see, this is what the issue is with these corporate personhood rights, is that based on that idea that the Supreme Court ruled that the existing legislation that Congress had passed, the McCain-Feingold campaign finance laws, were unconstitutional because they violated corporate First Amendment rights to speak. And then they wedded that with another Supreme Court decision, I think from 1978, that established that money, spending money in political campaigns was a form of speech, and so to limit that was limiting speech. So those two came together, and they basically, and in this case, it's written in the decision itself that corporations are persons under the law, or some variation of that. So now it's a firm precedent. I mean, actually, this issue of corporate personhood has been around since over 100 years, it started back. Ironically, I think it was a popular uprising in Paris in the late 1870s that was the first story that was cabled, transatlantic cable, that was a daily story followed by people in the United States. And it was workers and the National Guard in Paris. They, for a brief period of time, they set up their own government. They drove out the army of Napoleon II. I hope I'm not bastardizing this history, but and that was so frightening to some of the big industrialists of the day, and that they began to really fear this threat of democracy from below. And out of that, actually, they gave birth to this idea of the corporations could claim constitutional rights and then use those rights to overturn our democratically enacted laws. So for the last century, they've increasingly claimed these rights. And so that's why it's not just the First Amendment free speech. It's also there's Fourth Amendment rights that they've claimed of search and seizure that have allowed corporations to elude regulatory agencies from doing surprise inspections and, has allowed them to get away with corporate pollution and other worker safety violations. And there's Fifth Amendment rights that they've used, and 14th Amendment Commerce Clause related rights. So,
but didn't it all start with the 14th Amendment? That was back with the Santa Clara County versus the Southern Pacific Railroad.
Exactly.
And that was the foot in the door on the basis of the 14th Amendment, which was meant to free the slaves, and suddenly for reasons which are completely incomprehensible, they were used to create corporate personhood. But
that's it.
I guess the biggest leap forward, because the application to the Fourth and the Fifth, I think the Fourth Amendment case has been heard and the Fifth Amendment's case been heard. Have they been both ruled on?
Yeah, I mean, there are cases from over the past century.
Well, there was some recent one, though, I believe.
And certainly this Citizens United is the most damaging of all, because I mean, essentially, it puts our entire government up for sale, and it completely undermines our democratic process. So, I mean, without a democratic or true democratic process, I mean, you know, we're no longer in control of our government.
Right.
This is certainly has the most serious implications of all.
So, what about Mary Beth Fiedler, again, the founder and coordinator of Move to Amend LA, who spearheaded the successful effort to get the LA City Council to approve a resolution amending the Constitution to deny corporations personhood? Is there a possibility, since this is absurd, don't you think, that the idea that the amendment to free the slaves was applied to these poor, beleaguered corporations like Santa Fe, Southern Pacific Railroad, in the days of the railroad barons, and now it's been used to free up the big corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money on a government and a Congress that they already own. What about the idea of in terms of the popular zeitgeist, if you will, of pointing out the absurdity? Because the comedian Stephen Colbert seems to be heading in that direction. I believe he's gone to South Carolina to try and introduce a resolution that will allow your daughter to date a corporation.
Yeah, I think that is a great approach because comedy is so powerful. I mean, so the first thing is to make people even aware that this doctrine exists, and then to understand how it affects us. So I think those efforts are great because then people go, "What? That's so funny!" But yeah, here's the real story behind it. So, a big challenge is education, and that's why also on a local level, even though we, are so thrilled that we passed the resolution, we have a lot of work to do, educate all kinds of different groups. So, one of the things we have is a speakers bureau that will go out to, neighborhood councils, churches, environmental groups, Rotary clubs, every single group we can, because really also this needs to be it needs to cut across any kind of partisan lines if it's going to be successful. And so I believe that I was just saying to my sister, I was explaining to her what I'm doing, and she's an evangelical Christian that lives in Texas. And she was completely on board and agreed, and I was happy to hear that. So I think that, it's not necessarily even a partisan issue. And so we need to go out and we need to talk to as many kinds of groups as we can. So that's why we really need help. And we need, we're trying to get ourselves even further organized because, of course, now our organization is growing by leaps and bounds. But we want to get ourselves organized so that we can really have kind of an army of dedicated volunteers. We're all volunteers to go out and do this heavy lifting and educate people. But I do want to say, too, that this has been such a it's been really great fun because, first of all, we succeeded, and that's always fun. And we have a very clear, specific goal, and we're united in our belief in the importance of that goal. And great people have been working together and bringing all kinds of different expertise that I myself could never have provided, just like alone or with the small group of people that we started with back in January. So I want to encourage, all the listeners out there who are, wringing their hands and just sometimes looking around and thinking, oh, my God, just to come and roll up our sleeves and let's really make this happen.
So, Mary Beth, did you tell your sister in Texas that you believe corporations are persons if Governor Perry executed one?
I should tell her that. I didn't tell her that. I wanted to be as little provoking as I could. But yeah. Anyway, but she just moved to Texas. She's not actually a native Texan. But
I see.
Yeah. But But I mean, yes, exactly. I mean, the whole concept that corporations are persons is just so absurd. And that example. Right.
The bad news is it's the law of the land. And it has to be overturned, and it's a high bar that's been set, but only if all the people get on board can it be done.
Yeah, and the thing is, the Revolutionary War generation—they risked their lives for this ideal of democracy, and I don't think that they were fighting for the likes of the British East India Tea Company to be running their government. In fact, there's many, many quotes of the founding fathers and, up to Abraham Lincoln and, various other iconic figures of American history warning against the potentially corrosive, destructive power of big corporations and how they could basically destroy the republic in its infancy if they were allowed to control the government. So I think they would be cheering us on, and, if they could risk their lives to establish this ideal of democracy, I think it is really up to us now to defend it, to recover it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mary Beth Fiedler.
Okay. And also, can I just say before we get off, we go to movetoamendla.org if you would like to work with us. We have a contact link. And also movetoamend.org, the national site, has all kinds of information. Our local one we just set up, and our team of volunteers is working on it, but the national one also. If you want to get further educated about the issue, please go to both those sites. And also, we have a big action coming up January 20th, Occupy the Courts. Over 50 cities around the United States are going to stage actions at courthouses to educate people about the connection between the courts and the hijacking of our democracy.
Again, I thank you for joining us, Mary Beth Fiedler, the founder and coordinator of Move to Amend LA. She spearheaded the successful effort to get the LA City Council to approve a resolution amending the Constitution to deny corporations personhood. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the elections in the Congo and the violence that is likely to pursue it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jacques Bahati, who is the policy analyst for the Africa Faith and Justice Network, whose mission is to promote just U.S.-Africa relations through advocacy and education. He is a Congolese citizen who has witnessed the invasions of the Democratic Republic of Congo by Rwanda, Burundi, and Uganda, and has worked in the field of on post-war relief. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacques Bahati.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
And Jacques, the election results should be out at any moment, right? They were due, I think, yesterday. What's the latest information that you have?
The latest information is that the results will be released on the 8th, unless they change. So we are all waiting and to hear who will be the new president.
Well, the new president could be the old president, right? In 2006, Joseph Kabila won a runoff and then became the country's first elected leader in 46 years. But then that happened amid a lot of election-related violence, did it not?
Yes. In 2006, the Congolese people elected Kabila Joseph as the president, and on the 28th of this month, he was on the ticket, and the preliminary results showed that he might be again the president of Congo. However, there is a lot of anger around the fact that he might be the president and work for another term, whereas there have been no change in the conditions of livelihood of the Congolese people.
Well, he apparently, the current president, Joseph Kabila, apparently changed the constitution to help his own chances get reelected. And an international election monitors have reported enormous amount of fraud in this election. So will anybody believe the results when they come through the day after tomorrow?
In fact, the president changed the constitution from two rounds to one round alone, and he did it in a legal way. Although it was legal, it does not mean it was the right thing to do for the Congolese people and the democratic process that is still in the early stages. The results are already being contested for different reasons. The fraud and also lack of competency of the Electoral Commission, the cozy relationship of the chairman of the commission, on the long list of many other things. So definitely the results will be contested, and the Americans, the Europeans have deployed diplomats to Kinshasa to try to mediate the situation, calm the politicians, and we are waiting with anticipation to see what happens.
So the people that are running against Kabila, who are likely to lose and won't be very happy about it, and I understand most of them have their own private militias. One of them I saw on the BBC when the reporter tried to talk to him. He intimidated the reporter. He didn't like the questions he was being asked and pointed to his militia henchmen and said, "You better be careful what you say around here. Some of these people may not be happy with what you're saying." I mean, it really sent chills down you. So give us a sense of who the other candidates are that in this election.
The opposition is very divided, and you have many candidates, 10 candidates in the opposition. We have Tshisekedi as the main candidate for the opposition. We have Vital Kamerhe. Also, we know that somebody like Mbusa Nyamwisi was on the list, but the history of crime under his name is very obvious.
Right, he's the warlord that I was referring to. Yeah,
that's yeah. Correct.
Right.
So the intimidation that you saw in our report or heard in our report is the daily bread of the Congolese people. Many Americans don't understand what it means to live in a country where you can't say what you think. Not only the state is against you, but you have no hope that probably things will change soon. So that is where we are stuck. As of yesterday, we got a report that some soldiers were being arrested for nothing. And, politicians from the opposition have been arrested, they are in jail. So it is very, very difficult for even activists like me to operate in Congo. And I salute my brothers and sisters who work tirelessly to really improve the human rights and the conditions of the people and exposing and opposing the oppression in Congo. Those operate in difficult conditions more than we can think of.
Well, I understand, Jacques Bahati, that the rebels and the Congolese army are equally accused of terrible violence, massacres, and sexual violence as well. So there's no security, right? Who can you trust? And you've got up to 20,000 UN peacekeepers in the country, but they don't seem to be able to contain things.
Indeed, there is nobody you can trust in such a system. The only institution that is trustworthy in Congo is the Catholic Church and other churches. Those have been providing services, and they have been adequate in really maintaining some level of life. Instead, the officials are there to take things from you, corruption and so on. Now, when it comes to the crimes of rape, the Congolese army, some elements in the Congolese army have been accused of rape. Indeed, it's not an accusation, it's a fact, because some have been tried. Also, some members of the United Nations peacekeeping mission have been also accused of rape, and it's a fact. So the Congolese people have been victimized from every angle. So it has been a very, very difficult life for the people in Congo since the war started in 1996 by an invasion from Rwanda and Uganda. Also bring in the Burundians and other allies to the government from the West.
Everything sort of started to fall apart, if you will, with the genocide in Rwanda, where the Hutus massacred the Tutsis, and the Tutsis retook the country and drove the Hutus into the Congo. So take us from there in terms of all these outside forces getting involved. Because there are a lot of Hutus living in the Congo as well, right?
Yes. We have to denounce the tragedy that happened in Rwanda in first place. That is terrible to have a genocide in this century. But unfortunately, the new regime in Rwanda took the war into Congo and also equally massacred people. And a recent report by the United Nations released on October 1st of 2010 described in details what kind of atrocities they committed as they followed those who committed the genocide in Congo. And there is also accusation, or the report says that actually the Rwandan troops could be liable for genocide to be determined by a adequate court. So the Congolese people were murdered. Men and women, children, unarmed people. And I was there. I saw what happened to them. I saw the mass graves of many people. And in addition to killing the Congolese people, they killed the Rwandan refugees, women and men, children who were unarmed. They killed the Burundian refugees who were on the Congolese territory. So the crimes detailed in the mapping report are very, very disturbing, and evidence is overwhelming, and justice must be served for those victims. And unfortunately, as the politicians were trying to fight for power, no one spoke about justice for those people, and we are talking about millions of individuals who were murdered.
So in the last couple of minutes, let's talk a little bit about Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army, which comes out of Uganda. And now the United States is deploying troops in Uganda, supposedly to advise the Ugandans about how to eliminate this army. But this army is inside the Congo. So give us a sense of that war front.
The Lord's Resistance Army has been committing crimes in Congo as well for a long time. In addition to committing crimes in neighboring countries, South Sudan and Central African Republic, and so on. So the U.S. just sent 100 advisors to the nations involved to help out in the hand down of this man. However, we understand that the religious leaders in northern Uganda, the Acholi leaders, have called this move a wrong move because they believe in peaceful resolution, and they still believe that not every step has been taken to really get Kony to come back. These people believe that Kony can come back and be restored in their community because he belongs to their tribe, despite the crimes he committed there. So it's a different approach. The might of the Americans and also the restorative justice approach and African mechanism is also should be also given space in search for solution.
Well, less than a minute, if you could just fill me in a little bit on the enormous amount of money that global corporations are extracting from the Congo and the role that plays in this continued violence.
Oh, the natural resources is a big problem and continues to fuel the conflict. So recently, the American lawmakers passed a law that prohibits American companies and others to really get in the trade of illicit minerals from Congo. So the money from these resources continue to buy weapons and finance the militias. And unfortunately, President Kabila and other members of the Congolese officials own mines. Therefore, it has been difficult to implement those kind of efforts that are geared to really break the network that finances this militia.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today. Again, Jacques Bahati, policy analyst for the Africa Faith and Justice Network. He's a Congolese citizen who has witnessed the invasions of the Democratic Republic of Congo by Rwanda, Burundi, and Uganda, and has worked in the field on post-war relief. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we started out talking with Rania Kalik, writes for Alternet. She's written and researched non-lethal weaponry as well as lethal weaponry as America's police forces have become more and more militarized. We've learned that since 1997, with the passage of a congressional act, that the Pentagon has been funneling enormous amounts of really lethal military hardware, tanks, etc., to police forces. This year, last year, 2010, $500 million worth were essentially given away. And next year, it's going to be four times that, $2 billion worth of surplus heavy military equipment. And of course, as these small police forces around the country get this equipment, then they feel obliged to train their soldiers, their policemen, to use this equipment, and thus the militarization takes a life of its own. The other thing that's driving this, of course, is the Department of Homeland Security, who since 9/11 have just been pouring money into police stations around the country or police forces around the country, a lot of it in rural communities. 500 of these Bearcat-type tanks have been paid for, essentially given to police departments, many of them in small rural communities. And all of this is happening when the crime rates are at a 40-year low in terms of violent crime. So guess what this equipment is going to be used against? Citizens, most of whom will be protesting for their rights. That seems to be the way we're heading, because it's certainly not being used against violent criminals. Then we spoke with Mary Beth Fielder, the founder and coordinator of Move to Amend LA. They just had a successful effort to get the LA City Council to approve the resolution to amend the Constitution to deny corporations personhood. This is a part of a national movement. It's an awfully high bar that the founding fathers set to amend the Constitution. It takes 2/3 of the legislatures with a 3/4 vote. But it has to begin somewhere, and it's at least here in Los Angeles, there's been a beginning. But cities all around the country are passing these resolutions, and eventually it will catch on. And some of the comedians like Stephen Colbert are contributing, pointing out the utter absurdity of corporations being persons in law, being protected by the First Amendment, as the Citizens United decision did, and the idea that you could let your daughter marry a corporation, which is Stephen Colbert's idea, may help point out the utter absurdity of this. Then finally, rarely you hear about the Congo. I found a Congolese activist, Jacques Bahati, who'd witnessed many of the wars and atrocities in the eastern Congo. He's been in the field there. He says, you know, it takes an enormous amount of courage to work in the field there. The elections are still disputed. The results are supposed to come out any day now, likely to spike a new round in violence. World's biggest contingent of UN peacekeepers can't possibly contain the peace. But at the end of the day, a lot of Western businesses are making fortunes out of minerals, and they're kicking back money to these crooks with these militias who murder their own people. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One time.